Welcome back to another episode of Consciously Clueless, the podcast that teaches you how to live a healthier lifestyle that makes you and the planet happier. The world is changing quickly. Sometimes it feels like you can't keep up. I hear you. You want to make the world a better place, you care, but you don't know where to start. You know taking care of yourself is important, but how? I get it. I have a history of diving into a new endeavor, seeking perfection, and quickly feeling like I failed. Whether it was going vegan or learning how to recycle more, I wish I had guidance to keep me on track and not overwhelmed. I can't lie, the world needs your help, but it doesn't need you to be perfect. This podcast is here to help. Here we go. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Corey Lee Wren, sociology professor from the University of Kent.
I stumbled upon your work looking at veganism and sociology and was overjoyed to find your website, quite honestly. I have a lot of questions, but I would love to start with your journey to veganism personally.
As you may be able to hear from my accent, I am from the South in the United States, and more specifically, I'm Appalachian. And veganism, when I was born in the 80s and when I became vegan at the turn of the century, it didn't exist and people weren't even vegetarian. So it is a weird one for me as a sociologist. How did I come to exist coming from that area? But I can look back and think about lots of different connections I had with other animals and some interventions I did as a child. And so there was something a little bit different about me, not just being empathetic with other animals, but feeling like I had the responsibility to intervene. But how to actually get into veganism, the dietary aspect of it, was I was watching a cooking show with my mother, and the show was called The Frugal Gourmet on PBS. I haven't seen it on TV since I was a kid, so I don't know what happened to it, but it was this guy. He would go and collect his ingredients from all the different shops in town, and he went to a butcher shop to get some animal bodies. And in the window of the butcher shop, you could see pigs' heads hanging. And I was 13 at the time. And I said, you know what? That's horrifying. And it's not for me. And I said something to my mom, I'm going to be vegetarian now. And she says, yeah, okay.
Right.
So part of me wonders that's why I stuck with it, is because not just the empathy, but also my mom thinking, oh, you'll never be able to do that. Let me show you, mom. Like, as a teenager. But anyway, this was when I went vegetarian. That was in the 90s. So we didn't have the internet back then. So I actually hand wrote a letter to PETA, which at the time was based in Virginia. I sent them a letter and they sent me back a whole bunch of just brochures and pamphlets and all that kind of stuff. And I read it and I realized it's not just the basic of don't eat animals because that's their bodies, but there's a whole litany of other things to consider with the oppression of non-human animals. And so I decided that as soon as I got out of that house, because we grew up very poor and my mom was making special meals for me as a vegetarian. There's just no way they're going to be able to handle vegan. So I said, the second that I get out of here and I'm living on my own independently is the second I go vegan. And so I went vegan the first day of university. I was 17 at the time. That was 2001. But even between that, I did, like I said, activist moments I can remember. So for instance, I think I might've been a sophomore or a junior in high school, and I was taking an anatomy and biology class, and we were expected to dissect a little baby pig. And I said, absolutely not. I'm not going to do that. And I was already aware, because I'd gotten my literature from PETA, that I had rights as a student and I didn't have to do it.
Oh, wow.
So that I had that like courage to do it, where I know most students would feel like I'm powerless. I don't have any rights or whatever. And that's how they get you. They just crush you into
right.
it. But anyway, I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so the teacher said, your alternate assignment is to write an essay on the merits of animal testing. How vindictive is that? How vindictive. So guess what I did? I wrote up an essay on all the problems with animal testing, and I got a big fat zero on it. And Mrs. DeGroote, if you're still out there somewhere.
I was just going to say, shout out. You have your PhD now, so.
Lesson was learned. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for the inspiration.
So yeah, that's that kind of stuff. So even if I wasn't eating vegan, I was in the vegan mentality. So that was my history. I don't know how I came into it. It just paid attention to my empathy and felt responsible.
Paid attention to your empathy. That's something right there, right? I think unpack for a lot of people as we're questioning things, as we learn about veganism. That cognitive dissonance piece that we have to unravel is so related to our empathy and actually hearing it and not turning away. And I think that that's hard.
Yeah, especially for kids. Like when I'm having, my mom doesn't believe in me. Well, to now she's totally supportive when I come home to visit. She's even got the vegan dishwashing liquid and all that kind of stuff.
Cute.
But thinking about it as a kid though, when you have your parents who aren't believing in you and think it's just a phase, when you have your teachers who are trying to crush it out of you, when none of your friends are doing it, this is the sociology of why does anyone want to go vegan when everything is set against you and you're alienated and stigmatized and discouraged? So you really have to push, you have to really push and set aside your own feelings, really, to say that this is the right to do, even the right thing to do, even if it makes me feel like crap and I don't feel included or I'm made to feel stupid or whatever.
Is this early discovered passion what led you into sociology in and of itself, so you could do this more, or were those two things that kind of converged later?
That website exists because I want to be the person I didn't have when I was a student, because I did not know you could do animal stuff seriously. So what happened was, growing up in the 90s and growing up in the early 2000s, where animal rights was certainly not very popular, veganism was not very popular, and academically was not, it didn't exist. I said, what's the next best thing? I'm interested in social justice. So the joy for people who aren't in the US, like for instance, I'm in the UK now, it's a whole different ball game. But in the US, you get to go to university and take classes that interest you. You don't have to necessarily choose and commit to a major. You can explore a little. So I did that. I took classes that are interesting to me. I took classes about culture, about global issues, about social justice, inequality, gender, all that kind of stuff. And then I turned around at the end of my junior year. This is awful. I changed majors quite a lot. But I turned around at the end of my junior year when I'm about to graduate, I have one more year left, and said, okay, what do I have here? How can I make a degree out of this? And it turned out political science was the main one. And then the second one is taking quite a lot of sociology. And if I keep tinker with this a little bit more, I can get a minor in it. So that's how I did it. I followed what was important to me first and then said, how does the university support those interests? But that's how it went. And then getting into animal stuff. So even as an undergraduate, it just did not exist. So when I got into graduate school, I was doing my master's degree also at Virginia Tech. And again, I didn't think I could do it. So I did the next best thing. I was doing environmental justice in Appalachia because green stuff, at least, was
Interesting.
starting to become cool. So
Yeah,
no animal
totally.
stuff. But
And
what
not
did
connecting them, right? Not connecting
it? Of
them
course
in the
not.
same way.
Which, by the way, I actually want to go back to my master's thesis that's now a million years old, but go back and reintroduce animals into that and maybe expand.
Oh,
Because that's
interesting.
another whole, that's a new kind of interest of mine about Appalachian studies and about how non-human animals have been absent from that, even though they're a major part of the culture, which is a whole nother conversation. But anyway, as far as like in academia, as a master's student, I was doing this environmental stuff, but I was also full-time working at a research transportation institute, which is the most dull thing I've ever had to do in my life. But I was also active in the
It
animal rights.
sounds it. I'm
Yeah.
not gonna lie.
They won't be listening. I can say the truth. But I was also president of the Animal Rights Club at Virginia Tech at that time. And I found that was what was motivating me. The dissertation, like I care about environmental issues. It's a major part of my life and career now still, but I feel like there was already people on board for that, but nobody was there for the animals. And so I focused so much. It was actually becoming a part-time job, the work that I was investing into this Animal Rights Club. And so then I went on, I knew I wanted to get a PhD. And if I'm totally frankly honest about why I got a PhD, is because I grew up poor and I didn't want to be poor. And I knew that as a poor person from Appalachia, education is the way out of that. So I'm just going to get a PhD. So by this point, I'm in sociology. By happenstance, as I gave the story, there's a chance. And then to get my master's degree, I ended up doing sociology because the school I went to at first did not require a GRE in for sociology. And I, being a corn husk from Appalachia, did not know what a GRE even was. And so if I wanted to keep on with a master's degree, not miss out on any time, I went to this university, Longwood University, and outside of Appalachia, but in Virginia. Discreet.
Also, just a side note, screw the GRE. I took it
Thank
twice and got the same scores and ended up
you.
in a grad school program that didn't require it. I have such a
See?
bone to pick.
Yes, thank you. So this, but this shout out to anyone listening and thinking about doing this. There are
Ugh.
things you have to know about, and we weren't told. So
Yes. Yes.
it worked. In this case, it worked out. So I had to wait a year to do the GRE. I was in another university, and all they had was that didn't require the GRE was the sociology programs. Sociology, it is. I did my minor in that. Anyway, so that's how I fell into sociology. But by the time I was ready to do my PhD, I knew sociology was for me. The mechanisms, the structure of it, the critical structure of it, that this is how I think. And I feel like that's going to be very powerful. So I started applying to different PhD programs. Specifically, I really wanted to go to Colorado State University because they focused on environmental issues. So this is a place for me. And it's quite cutting edge at the time to the whole program, not just sociology, but the other ones, like political science, even philosophy. They were all focused on green issues. It was very cool. But I emailed the when I was applying, I emailed them and said, I wanted to do this. I want to focus on hunting. Again, I'm afraid to do animal stuff. How can I shoehorn it into the environmental stuff? And they're like,
Right.
well, we don't know if we can do that. Ah. But anyway, I got in. And this is a turning point. So you can see the story thus far as I'm trying to shoehorn in when academia is not having it.
Yeah.
Get into this PhD program that I've been working my whole life. Here it is. I'm a PhD student. And we are doing this very first class on theory. And I very clearly remember sitting around this table with my colleagues, the cohort, and we're discussing George Herbert Mead, who does the sociology of, it's like a symbolic interactionist type of approach, how meaning is constructed and understood and shared through, different types of communication. And I, being the animal person there, started introducing this idea about how other animals might, this might apply to other animals. And the rest of the students were like, we're talking about him in conversations. And the module convener, the professor, intervenes. And bless her, she actually has turned out to be a good ally of mine. And she did try to get me out of animal stuff pretty hard, but she didn't succeed. But she shut it down. She shut it down and said, we will never know. So let's move on to the next topic. And in that moment, I said, it's time. Someone needs to speak for the animals. Now, mind you, I had no idea that I'm not the only one, that there's all these other people who are doing this sociological work on animals, but it just was so shut out of even a green institution, even a
Wild,
green
huh?
focusing on climate change and environmental injustice, did not have space for non-human animals, was shutting it down. And I said, that's it. Here we go. And I made that commitment. I said, every single thing that I do for this graduate program will be centered on animals. My dissertation is not about hunting now. No, it's about the animal rights movement. Here we go, full throttle. And that's how it happened. That's how it happened. It's just like resisting these attempts to shut down this important discourse. And that is why I worked with Zoe Sutton and so many other sociologists to create vegan sociology, like the website, the whole community, to say we exist. This is a normal area of study. It's a vital area of study. So we are making inroads into the discipline itself. It's not just students. So the American Sociological Association, being huge and enormous, really doesn't pay attention too much to what we do. But the British Sociological Association and the Australian Sociological Association, they have been extremely supportive. They share our call for papers. They help with funding for Zoom to get a big Zoom subscription to allow a lot of participants in our conference, all that. And so
Cool.
that is really, I think that is really exciting. It's not just opening up this possibility for students, but we're starting to create a discourse with the discipline itself. And we're starting to normalize the study of animals, not just the study of animals, critical liberatory study of other animals.
Oh my gosh, I have so many things flooding to my mind because I don't work directly in the field in sociology or women's studies. Those were my majors. But all this talk, I'm like getting all excited again talking about. But I'm curious because when I, story for another episode, but I thought I was going to get my PhD. I ended up not. I got my master's. But when I was applying for PhD programs originally, when I thought that's what I was going to do right out of undergrad, I was a sociology and women's studies double major. And so for me, I was like the practical, the study, the science. And then the women's studies gave me this more activism and this more boots on the ground mentality. And so when I was applying in my essay, I remember writing, I remember having this conversation with my advisor who was just trying to do the best to get me and make me successful. But I had in there, I want to combine my passion for research and then doing the work. And he was like, you should lessen up on that, like doing the work part, because some of these programs don't want an activist in the same way. And that was 2010. So it already is, or 2014, excuse me, where am I? 2014. So it's 10 years later. But has that been your experience in terms of talking about activism and this work? Uh-oh, your face in the field?
Yes.
Your face was like, oh, Carly.
Yeah, I do remember, for instance, that professor that shut me down in that conversation. And I went actually had a lot of respect for her because she was, besides that, which she probably didn't even think twice. She probably didn't
Right.
realize the impact that would have on me. But she was very supportive of my career and she recognized like my socioeconomic background and all that sort of stuff. I remember us sitting in her office and she was trying like hell to convince me, you need to do Appalachian stuff, get off of the animal thing. And I remember saying, the animals need me more. And she was like, yes, you're a bit scrappy. So I don't know. Just calling me scrappy was like a euphemism for you're the vegan feminist killjoy activist classroom sort of thing. Yeah, it certainly does get pushback. I do think that in academia, as an ac like now a professional academic, there's a little bit more space for that, especially in circles. And if you would have made it into the feminist bit, you would have been all right. It's just who's doing the reading of those letters and whatnot.
I remember being so dumbfounded. I remember just genuinely being like, then why would I research it if I wasn't going to go do something with it?
I wonder like where you were applying, because in feminism, I think there's a lot more acceptance for, because that's the whole point of feminist theory, is not just to read about it and
Right.
think to do it.
It was sociology PhDs, so he wanted me to make sure it was like, I'm not
Good.
applying for a women's studies PhD, or
Okay, yeah.
so there was a bit of, we've got to fit into sociology, which really gets cranky if you make it like any less legitimate.
Right. Yeah, so that's a big part of it, certainly with sociology. Although, unlike other disciplines, we tend to be a little bit more equitable as far as the gender ratio. That's great. But historically, sociology has always been a bit worried about being taken seriously, like the social science isn't real science or whatever. And so I do see that's an expectation in sociology is that you're not actually doing it. You're just thinking and writing and researching about it. But I don't know. I feel like sociology has a little bit more space for it than other disciplines, at least. But
True.
my divisional director calls me a public intellectual. And I sometimes wonder if that is also a
A public intellectual, is that another way of saying scrappy?
Yeah. Instead of sticking to the journals, I actually try to have these conversations with the people who use that information. To me, that's activism.
I couldn't agree more. And so I want to circle back to something that you mentioned with like Colorado State being this environmental studies, this green school, and still you having to shoehorn in conversations around animals. And I read this article from you from last year about why are environmentalists and animal activists at an impasse? And it's incredible work and put into words some things I've been grappling with. And so I would love to talk a little bit more about where is that disconnect, do you think, with those movements, with people who are like, save planet Earth, but won't talk about animals?
It's multifaceted. And this is something I've had this conversation a million times with my students. I teach environmental politics here at University of Kent, and I have a week in the middle on animals, and we specifically cover this debate. Are animal rights part of environmental politics, or is it something separate? There's been quite a lot of publication on this. Amy Fitzgerald is a sociologist in Canada who's written a book on it. But even some of the big environmental philosophers back in the 70s and 80s have kind of grappled with it. But there's two major issues that I think are going on. First off, in the history of environmental philosophy, which informs the environmental movement, there's this focus on systems, ecosystems, abstract kind of concepts about species, and not so much focus on individuals. And that's where animal rights differs significantly, because we're talking about animal rights. Animal rights is based on that sort of liberal political discourse of each individual has their own rights that they're entitled to, and don't tread on me kind of stuff. So that becomes difficult, because how then are you going to talk about managing or protecting or conserving large ecosystems, and then also protecting individual rights? Because historically, the environmental movement has seen death as in killing and culling, quote unquote, that's another euphemism, hunting, quote unquote, another euphemism, as compatible with conservation and protection, et cetera, because they're not thinking about individual rights, they're thinking about ecosystems. So that's historically a major division point. And so it's about now challenging that. How can we deal with these major ecosystem issues without also saying that certain groups are going to be more vulnerable and it's okay to intervene lethally? Because we would never do that with human overpopulation. We would never say, oh gosh, look at all the folks over in South Asia. Let's just go through and cull them all with cyanide and bullets and fishing nets or whatever else. Some people would say that, let's be honest. Some people would say
Yeah,
that. But
I know. I had this dark thought in my head. I was like, well,
unfortunately,
some people might, but they're.
in the United States, the conservative dark cloud that's looming for people listening, we're dealing the election is coming up. It's getting closer and closer, with Donald Trump looking more and more of a threat. Anyway, but realistically, most people, especially environmentalists, would never say, okay, let's go do this lethal management of.
Correct.
So they recognize then that there are certain rights that should not be violated. So that is a major, I think historically, that's a major kind of crux that
Interesting.
nowadays, though, actually before, when I was trying to figure out where to do my research, should I do hunting or should I do, still thinking I had to stick in environmental studies,
Right.
my next project until I switched over to the animal rights movement was I wanted to look at the environmental movement and why it was not taking animal agriculture seriously. Because at that time we had studies like the UN's landmark study, Livestock's Long Shadow, where it made it crystal clear that animal agriculture is a major, one of the leading contributors to climate change. And yet, if you went and I went to all the websites and looked through all the material of groups like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club, they didn't mention animal stuff at all. It was a complete silence on it. And it was just absolutely shocking to me. And of course, I'm sitting around with these people who are going to be the next leaders of these organizations who are not vegetarian, not vegan. I bike to work, but I eat hamburgers. So these are the people around me who are going to be the next leaders. And I'm wondering where is this disconnect? And it's not, I think a psychologist might look at this and say it's about privilege, your human privilege, you don't want to protect that. It's like part of that could be it. But I think actually a lot of this is more structural. So in academia, for instance, we cannot, this is the sad and ugly truth about it. In academia, it does not pay to be truthful. And we do a lot of manipulation of facts and research. This is something that I do in my animal studies class as well. It's like we look at that research and like, how has the research been manipulated? How does it get manipulated? It gets manipulated because the research we do increasingly is funded by outside sources. For instance, this is one of the reasons why there exists at all any research in the nutritional journals that meat and dairy is good for you when it's absolutely not, it's toxic. But if you look down at the conflicts of interest, say, oh, this has been sponsored by the Dairy Council or whatever, then they spend millions and millions each year to fund academics to create this quote unquote objective science to support their claims. But in environmentalism, the same deal happens. If you want to do vegan stuff, it's going to be stigmatized. It's going to be alienated. It's going to be marginalized. Nobody's going to give you funding to do it. And just bless. There's a colleague of mine who I went into a debate with him a couple of years ago at the British Academy because he'd gotten this big fellowship, this big award from the British Academy, which is like one of the most prestigious funding institutions in the UK. And he was a vegan himself, but the project was about how veganism is unrealistic and we need to make leeways and have more space for animal agriculture. Middle of the road stuff that's basically saying that veganism is an important threat. People care about it, but we need science to come in and show that it's unrealistic in some way.
Oh my God, I want to scream.
That's the kind of funding, like that's the kind you want to get funded. That's the kind of crap you have to say. You have to sell out and you have to sell out hard. There's no way that I could have gone and done a similar proposal and say, I want to talk about veganism and how veganism, not wishy-washy flexitarianism, reducitarianism, is a crucial, absolutely vital for saving the environment and for helping animals and human communities, da da da. It would never get funded. It just wouldn't. So that's part of it. Academia can be bought, let's put it that way. But another part is looking at the animal charities, the environmental charities. They too are bought. So they rely on quite a lot of funding from these foundations. And foundations are technically tax loopholes where industries, instead of paying the taxes that they have to pay back to society, which is supposed to compensate for all the exploitation they do, because it's a capitalist system. So they're exploiting humans, they're exploiting the planet, et cetera. Taxes are supposed to be, you pay back into the system. But if you pay back into the system, it might actually work against you. So what they do is they'll take that tax money and funnel it instead into foundations that they create. And then they say, get in line, write an application, and we will have a board of trustees who decide where that money goes. And you know, damn, they're not going to give that money over to Greenpeace. If Greenpeace is saying, everybody go vegan right now, immediately, it's an easy, accessible way to halt climate change. We're not going to do that because that would crumble the meat industry or all these other industries that rely on animal agriculture. Instead, they'll give that money to organizations who say, turn the tap off when you're brushing your teeth, turn the light off when you leave, or ride your bike to work every once in a while, maybe on meat, have a meatless Monday. Individualizing the climate change crisis is something that we are responsible for instead of them. But also, they're manipulating the production of knowledge. They're manipulating the understanding of risk, because this is a serious risk that we're dealing with animal agriculture and non-vegan food ways. So that is it in a nutshell. I think historically there's that philosophical divide, but now as a sociologist, I would say we need to pay attention to how capitalism and industries can manipulate academia, and how they can manipulate nonprofits, the places where we go to for objective knowledge and how to manage risk.
Oh my gosh, that was so helpful. There's something I've been thinking about lately, or honestly for a while, but has felt more top of mind for me lately, is this finding a balance of sharing this information. So I have this podcast and I am a content creator and I talk about mindfulness and veganism. Those are the two big things that I share about and help others with. And sometimes I want to share the big scary things. And then other times I'm like, that's not how everyone's receiving information. So I want to make it fun and I want to talk about food and talk about food's a big trip up for people. So here are some ideas. How do you find a balance? Or maybe you don't have to in academia in a different way. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's an issue for me because I'm a sociologist and I'm a trained critical analysis, so I'm always critical and it pisses people off. And
Same.
I'm aware of that, and I try to, especially when I'm teaching, I have to be very careful because they may choose the class, but they're going to be relatively ignorant to a lot of things I'm going to present. And especially
Right.
like I'm teaching my animal class right now, and a lot of them are vegan and vegetarian, but a lot of them are not. So I have to manage, like, how do I present this truth, these facts,
Yeah.
all this stuff, without making you feel like you're a deadbeat and you don't belong here and let's all get negative. And it's not easy when I mark papers and the critic, because you have, the point is, where do I put your mark? And so you focus heavily on the negative stuff. But if I gave somebody feedback and it's all negative, they're going to go cry and they're not going to feel
Right.
motivated. So I have to be very mindful, like, all right, pay attention to the glass half full. What are some of the positives here? And how can you motivate and engage someone in a way that's caring and sensitive and nurturing and all that kind of stuff? And what do you think? What do you do?
It's this double-edged sword, right? Because the reality is that it's, for me, what I believe is that it's crucial. It's vital to be talking about veganism and to make these shifts for saving humanity in any way, shape, or form. So for me, I'm like, that's a big deal. That's a big statement. And I believe that. But I also know not every single person's going to hear that, especially not right away. So can
Yes.
I share that's my overarching belief and then share this is what I've tried to do to answer your question, different ways to get there. Is it because you want better personal health? That's what was my first intro to plant-based eating. And then I went vegan, but it was because I felt like shit eating dairy. And that is it the love for the environment? Is it the animals and the cognitive dissonance? So I guess I try and share from different perspectives. And also sometimes I do try and have fun with it for my
Yeah.
own sake and for others, because if I don't find joy in it, it's depressing.
Yeah.
And if I don't show that there's joy to be found, who's gonna listen or be like, I want to live like her. She looks miserable all the time.
Right. Yes,
So
absolutely. And I can share a little bit of research on that to support your approach. And I think it's a right approach to take. The first off, what before I
that's
forget is,
validating.
yeah, but the first part about the joy, and I think that's, I've been dying to write a paper on this, the food culture and veganism and how we don't just fixate on how the food system is horrible. I think we're a bit over the top in how much we love vegan food, and we have social coming together, and like when you go to a vegan restaurant, yeah, and you find something vegan, and it's like, yeah, and you share on the internet, I found this vegan over here. And back in the day, before veganism was as popular as it is now, like we used to have, and we relied on friends on the internet, vegan friends on the internet, because you didn't have vegan friends in real life. And we would mail each other care packages, and the food was a major part of feeling joy, feeling connected. It was a social bit, and it was a bit of maintaining some kind of resiliency. But to the other part, so the joy part, I just want to highlight, that's very good that you do that. You don't want it to be all miserable, as we do want to actually have an imagination for the world we want to live in. And so we have to have make space for joy. As far as like how to reach different people, you're absolutely right. My colleague Roger Yates, a sociologist, he always points out it's like you can't have one fit for all people because not all people are the same. They have different backgrounds, different experiences, different resources, different belief systems, all that kind of stuff. So it does make sense to approach it from different angles. We do know from the research, depending on where you are, that certain things will motivate people more. So on average, for instance, in the US, and I think also in the UK, more people are motivated to go vegan because of animal rights reasons, which annoys me because the animal rights charities oftentimes are afraid to talk about animal stuff because it's too political, even though that's what motivates people more.
More than like food or the earth, planet stuff.
Right. So in Australia, that tends to be a bit more of the environment and health that motivates. Right? But again, this is based on different studies and it depends on their sampling techniques or whatever. I think overall, it tends to be animal rights stuff that motivates people more because you have to have something that's really morally motivating you to keep with it in a society that doesn't support that. And then also, not to knock on the dairy thing while that motivates you not to do it, I'm going to come back around to that. But oftentimes when we approach it in that way is it's a health issue and it's like a dietary issue that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with, well, are zoos okay? What about animal testing, et cetera?
Right.
However, one thing we can learn from social psychology is that our attitudes tend to reflect our behaviors. So for instance, if you do come into veganism because dairy is making you sick or because you are worried about greenhouse gas emissions, what will tend to happen is that our psyche will come around to match that and say, aha, I don't need animals. Maybe I am a person who cares about animals.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a big misnomer. We think that our behaviors follow our attitudes, but actually, the reverse tends to be true, where we have our behaviors and then we form attitudes about things based on that. So it's okay then, I think, to appeal to different communities and different things that interest them. And of course, we also have to talk about the race issue. Because the fastest growing vegan group in the United States right now is Black folk. And Black folk are not necessarily coming out of this as an animal rights sort of campaign. They're seeing this as a food justice type of food, that it's a resistance to hundreds of years of colonialism and the legacy of slavery and the absolute havoc that's being wreaked on people of color in their communities and these major health disparities. So who am I as a white woman to say, but animals? Because human beings are animals too, and they're also that's the framework that's working for them. Well, okay. And I would not be surprised at all if the Black vegan community, which may be more geared towards food justice and health right now, will start to incorporate more and more animal rights stuff because there are people who are Black vegans who are doing animal rights stuff as well. So let's see what happens. But I do think that you're absolutely right. You have to be a bit careful about shoehorning everybody into the same, this is what works for me, so it's going to work for you as well. We don't really have evidence that's the case. And we haven't talked about like graphic imagery as well. Is that something that you stay away from or that you use?
So for me personally, I've seen some footage when you first go and you look at things. I personally don't do a good job of handling that very often for myself. I follow a lot of those accounts and sometimes I have to mute them so I can follow them and not see, because I'm like, I know, and I'm here and I'm not going anywhere, and it hurts my soul and body, and I like sometimes get physically ill if I look at too many things.
Yeah.
So I know that doesn't work for me. That doesn't, it motivates you to a point, and then it just makes me sad.
Yeah.
So I share more of the statistics around what's happening, or the facts around what's happening, personally from my account versus the imagery, because I just know it doesn't work. It doesn't make me feel good. So I struggle with that sometimes, because I know that can be an important thing where you have that eye-opening moment of, oh, I had to see to know. I get it, but I struggle with it, honestly.
Every image is going to stick with you. There are things that I saw 20 years ago that I can still vividly,
Yep.
and I awake at night every night. And I'm gonna be totally honest with folks, because I do this for a living. Every night I have to, as I'm trying to relax and go to sleep, fight the temptation to fall into thinking about right now, this second, this is happening, and there,
Same.
and thinking about things that I saw. And it's, so I think it is very important also, not just for thinking about what motivates people to come into the movement. I think we need to also think about what motivates people to maintain in the movement, because we all, that loss, it's a bit of this is a feminist element, because the animal rights movement has historically been male dominated, male attitudes are taken to be normal. And so this idea of, I don't want to see it because it's going to really upset me. The animals need you. You need to see this so you can be a better educator and stick with it. They're dealing with it. Why can't you look at it? And that kind of mentality, it actually burns people out. And how is going to be helpful for anyone if we're wallowing in that? And also the feminist element to it is, we feel like that we owe it to animals to see these things, to bear witness. And I feel like the
That
sense
part.
of, like, they're living this and I can't see it and speak for what I'm seeing. So that, I think that is a
That's real.
feminist, that's feminine guilt, where we have to be selfless and put others first and suffer in order to do better for others. I think we need to be very mindful of that, because it's not really going to get us very, we can't psychologically sustain. But
That.
the research, by the way, is not even very clear that as far as getting people to come on board, it's unclear if it's effective. It works for some people, it doesn't work for other people. And there's also the idea that we need, there's research that's been published on this by people outside of the movement and major sociological journals, saying that we have to keep looking at this to motivate ourselves as activists. Like, actually, no, what I found in my research is that when people enter the movement and they're committed to the movement, they start to actively do exactly what you did: mute, curate, unfriend, remove that. Because if I see one little bit that pops up on my Twitter feed, and I actually have to be very careful on Twitter because it'll suggest stuff for me, and just because they know I do animal stuff, I'll see that, oh, now I know how crocodile skin bags are made and what happens to crocodiles in this facility, and like, and I will never be able to think, I mean, get that out of my mind. So we have to be very mindful that we live in a society where this type of normalized violence is actually socializing our activists to think that this normalized violence is, we need to continually be exposed to it to be effective. I don't,
Oh.
I think that's one of the reasons we need to be, have a feminist critique in the animal rights movement, this kind of self, this derogation, if you will, of having emotions and needing to manage them in some way that you can kind of get through the day.
I think that's so helpful. And I think that happens a lot in terms of, there's so many examples while we're recording today of shit going on in this world, and that you are trying to find the balance of, wh how do I honor and look and engage, and how do I not look at too much, so I don't care anymore. There becomes a time where you like see so much of that trauma and that pain without being mindful. For me, at least, and I don't think I'm alone in this, you just start to say, check, I check out, because what's the point? There's too much. And that's why
Yes.
I don't want to oversaturate. And maybe I don't do enough. Maybe that's something to examine too, in terms of what I share.
You always feel like you don't do enough. You could do
Word. Oh my
anything.
gosh.
You always feel that way, and you have to accept it.
I think your comments about a feminist critique of the animal rights movement is so interesting. And I haven't thought about it with that language before, but it's so right, because it's so white male dominated. And maybe that's a little bit of what I'm unraveling, is that's not exactly what vegan activism always has to look like.
Right. Because I think that the Vegan Society did a really interesting, and I would love to see the data on how effective it was. But I think the Vegan Society had an interesting alternative to this. So the idea is, if okay, we're not going to show the graphic imagery, then what else? So a lot of people, I used to still do what you did. I'll rely on a rational argument. I'll rely on statistics and information, which is still a very patriarchal type of, we don't need emotion to make decisions, even though 80% of our decision making is based on emotion. But okay, so we don't want to fall into that masculine trap of just data, numbers, which is safer for us. But then what's the alternative? So the Vegan Society did this really interesting campaign. I think it was like right before lockdown or during lockdown, where they were trying to spotlight our positive connections with other animals. The Go Vegan World in Ireland does a similar thing. They also use some of the graphic stuff, but they also try to highlight what most humans already feel, and that is a connection to other animals. Most people would say, yeah, I love animals, or they're interested in animals. They'd sit down and watch a wildlife documentary or pay to go to a zoo or whatever. People love animals. We have that connection to them as a social species. That empathy is built into our brains. And so the Vegan Society, I thought, was quite smart in that let's appeal to these pro-social values that people already have about animals. And it's not a way that's going to be shameful. It's not a way that's going to alienate or scare or traumatize. If you care about animals, then this veganism is for you. Veganism is in your heart already. So it's just a matter of aligning your behaviors with that attitude. Of course, that kind of becomes backwards from what I was telling you earlier about our behaviors tend to motivate our attitudes, but at least they're trying to align with our values already in a positive way. And it's a way that's more, I do care about other animals. Maybe I am a vegan and could be vegan.
A phrase I've been playing with lately that's been helping me and motivating where I'm coming from is that veganism is an act of love. And whether it's for yourself, whether it's for the people around you, for the animals, and I've been trying to come from that space because that a video of me and our family dog, and then talking about statistics of, or not statistics, but just the idea of why love this one and not the other. That's effective too. And coming from it from this act of love, like you said, and not all the time, but maybe coming from love all the time, but not just ignoring all the bad stuff all the time is what I mean, but can be effective. People are like, oh shit, I love my dog. Damn, that can be something too. And I, or like visiting an animal sanctuary, and then I have videos of this, a pig following me like a puppy. And I've used those videos with text overlay of, did you know that about the animal agriculture industry? Because it's like this image of this pig as your pet.
Person. It's a, yeah, individualized.
Exactly. So I've been trying to find ways of that feminine and masculine approach. I don't know, the word balance seems so cliche, but.
But I also don't want to negate the fact that most people are absolutely, completely ignorant about our food system, about what happens to other animals. And I've
True.
had so many examples about this, but there was, I just read one report. It was done in the UK, and it was something like 40% of people did not know that dairy milk came from cows or something like really ignorant like that. And they didn't know where chicken nuggets came from. And people just don't think about it. They don't think about where this stuff comes from.
And
But
it's by design we don't know, right? Like the sides, the side of the truck carrying the cows, they look very happy.
yep. Yeah. So that's why it's important to do those videos that you do where it shows it disrupts that categorical thinking we have of other animals. First off, there's also the categorical thinking where this animal's for this animal's for that, and therefore they have no or life or whatever. They don't have, they're not sentient, self-aware, but also segregated. So those videos disrupt the segregation. These animals, like most humans do not have, at least in the West, a daily interaction with cows or pigs or other animals that they're consuming. So that's where, sociologically speaking, it's important to show those types of videos because it disrupts that categorical thinking we have with other animals, and it disrupts that segregation, and it brings in a little bit of knowledge that most people do not have. So I just, and as another example of just, I don't want to poop on my students, but just like the extreme ignorance that people have. And again, it's not really their fault. It's just the system is designed to keep them ignorant. And when I was teaching in New Jersey, I taught an intro sociology class, and I had a whole week on speciesism. And one of the things I did was gave them the numbers. And I don't like to rely on the graphic videos and all that stuff, so I'm just presenting it factually. But I gave them the numbers. Like this at the time, I think the number back then was like 64 billion animals that were killed annually for food. And then I gave them a study guide and said, this is going to be covered on the exam. And so they presumably went and studied for it. And when I put that, I actually made it an extra credit question so I could measure, like, what do people actually think? How many animals are killed worldwide every year? And they were coming up with 27,000 or
Holy shit.
a million. Like these really ridiculously small, 27,000. It's like that many turkeys were killed alone in this county for Thanksgiving. Like,
Right.
the numbers are so astronomically low. I was absolutely flabbergasted at that because they had been presented, these are college educated people. They had been presented with this information in a university lecture. They were incentivized to study this for an exam. And I made it an extra credit question so they could get bonus points on their exam for it. And still people are getting these ridiculous numbers. So if there's no hope for them, how is there hope for the average consumer? They're not going to have to completely divorce from the reality of it. So it is important to push back on that with education. It is
Yeah.
important to personalize animals and show them as not just unfeeling blocks of meat that are stupidly walking to slaughter and have no awareness of what's going on. They absolutely do know what's going on, and they absolutely do have individual personalities. So I think that is a really good way then of doing advocacy that is not relying on just blood and gore everywhere and
Right.
traumatizing.
How do you take care of yourself when you are doing this work and you sometimes are lying in bed and thinking of the images you've seen, which I couldn't relate to more? Why is it always that stuff comes up when it's quietest, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder what you do to take care of yourself through all this.
This is a very good question, and actually what I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, because now I realize I've been doing this. I've went vegan over 20 years ago now, and I've been doing this animal rights work. Now I'm a professional animal rights scholar. I got hired at the University of Kent, doing it full time. This is all my writing and research. It's here to stay. And I've been
Yeah.
thinking about, like, how am I going to go the rest of my life doing this? I'm very privileged to do it. I don't think I could have a better job to do what I do. But how am I going to do it? And the other kind of incentive that I've been really thinking about it quite a lot lately is last year, this time last year, there's a new documentary that came out on the milk industry in India. And it was one of those cases where in my classroom, everybody has these misnomers and myths about what happens in India. All the cows are revered in India and they're sacred, and which is going to be further from the truth. It's an industrializing nation and cows suffer incredibly. But I thought I'll just listen to this documentary so I can get a little bit. I want to be up to date on the field and be able to represent what's going on to my students. So I just put on the documentary while I was working and put it on just the audio so I couldn't see what was going on because I knew that the video that would trigger me. But then, of course, most of it's in Hindi. So I had to keep opening up the video to see what was going on. And in the first 20 minutes of that, I was so effed up from it. I cannot tell you. I cried for days. And it was really my partner at the time, we'd only just started dating, and he was like, he didn't know what to do with it. He's not vegan. He's just like, he
He
didn't
was like, "Are
understand why I
you
was.
broken?"
Yeah, it was, I think it was really weird for he didn't understand.
Yeah.
And it was just really awful. And I was a real mess. I had the same reaction 20 years prior when I saw Earthlings, which got tricked into seeing it. I was doing the animal rights club, but I wasn't president, I was vice president. So that meant I felt like I had to go to all the meetings. And they said, oh yeah, we're going to do a screening of Earthlings. So I felt it was my duty to sit there and watch it when I should have just got up and left, because I can still remember all kinds of crap from that movie.
I haven't seen the whole thing. I can't do it.
Yeah, I can remember then, like I was in bed for a week. It was so psychologically traumatic. And on quite frankly, it's a secondary post-traumatic stress disorder. That's 100% what it is. Many of us have that. And my recent research on people who've been a long time in the movement and how they deal with this information, this imagery, they're using a lot of the language. It makes it quite clear this is secondary PTSD. So that's, so in a nutshell, I've been thinking quite a lot about that. How can I do what I do authentically and have the appropriate information to be a representative of other animals without also spiraling? Because it's sometimes I feel like I don't know, like, how can I deal with this information? I have to actively, consciously in bed at night say, do not go there, do not go there, do not go there, do not go there, do not go there. And I do yoga. I've tried meditation. I'm not good at it. And I know it takes practice and all that kind of stuff. But the best thing I can do is yoga. And but yoga
Yeah.
does try to watch your thoughts and like don't just follow them anywhere they
It's a
go.
different way. It's a different way to do mindfulness. It's just all different paths.
So anyway, I don't I've been thinking a lot about this and wanting to do something I think as part of my scholar activism because a few months back I did a talk with Paul Gorski, who has done research in burnout and compassion fatigue in the animal rights movement. A lot of it is not to do with the moral shock, the morally shocking imagery. That's my interest. He was interested in how there was a lot of trauma associated with racism and sexism in the animal rights movement, which is not a, but that was a very well attended talk. And several animal charities actually reached out to me and wanted to make it a joint venture. And it says to me that there's a real hunger in the movement, especially in a movement that has historically denigrated sort of anything considered feminine. And we haven't been able to openly talk about mental health issues and grappling with some, this is like frontline stuff, like stuff that we're seeing. Like there's people who are in war zones. Like we see stuff that's worse that's happening in war zones. So I think that we do need to think collectively as a movement about how can we start to integrate structures on how to maintain well-being for participants. We're going to start losing people because who comes into the animal rights movement anyway? It's already people who are especially empathetic and
Yeah.
especially vulnerable to this type of stuff. So it's just something, I don't know, it's something for us to be thinking about. I just wanted to, my answer to that is it's something that's really on my mind lately, and I'm trying to think of ways to feed it back into the movement in a way that's effective. And I think one of the main aims for my career, it's not just speaking for animals, but most of my research actually is about the animal rights movement and structures within that movement, specifically looking at racism, sexism, classism, the influence of capitalism. Because I think the fact that animals matter, I think that's just common sense to me. What really matters to me is how can we make an effective movement to advocate for them? What do you have thoughts on that? What do you do?
It's interesting because what you said about structurally in the movement, what I did with my work was sociology, and my master's was in social responsibility, it was called. It was sociology, women's studies, human relations into one degree. The idea of it was really cool. The program was absolute shit, and I hope they hear me because they know. But what I was able to do with that work is become an advocate for survivors of sexual assault and dating violence. And that's the work I did for a couple years. And what I had to discover was that I was good at it, but it wasn't good for me.
Oh.
It was, at the time at least, I was unable and unequipped to take care of myself while having secondhand trauma from the stories of working on a college campus with survivors. And so I remember I was pl helping plan a conference for this Midwest or Minnesota sexual assault advocacy conference. We were talking about what sessions should be there. And I was like, self-care. We should talk about self-care for people who work in this. And someone who I really respect, who's been in this movement for so long, was like, don't people just know how to do that? And as I'm like twitching in grad school and doing this work, I'm like, no, I don't think people do. And I don't think people feel like they're allowed. And so it hit me really hard then. Of just, oh, we have to like actively be having these conversations about any field where you are working to help others, honestly. There has to be more conversation about self-care. So that kicked it into high gear in a different way for me. It's my yoga practice got more serious. I'm really diligent about mindfulness practices, even when I'm crabby about it. Like every morning, I write a couple things I'm grateful for. I read a small passage from this Meditations from the Mat book I have, and I try and do a 5-minute breathing exercise, a guided something. So 10 minutes total, maybe. But I try and do it every morning, even if I'm just like, this is stupid, because I know that in the long run, I feel better. So for me, it's been finding things that I connect to and then being consistent. Because I know at the end of the day, if I don't do them, I'll feel different. But I don't have, and I don't want to have a, this is what you do, because I think there's so many ways to take care of ourselves. But I think it's also important to reframe self-care as not a capitalist system, like buy into, you have to spend all this money and have this privilege to take care of yourself, because in some ways we know you do. But I just mean that you shouldn't have to. And that I really hate.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, what you were mentioning. We have to have these types of conversations. So, like I said, when I had that groundswell of people who wanted to join that workshop I put on,
Right.
I feel, but the other thing is, I think we're all fumbling around in the dark with it. I'm just a sociologist. How do I know? I just know from my own research what's helpful. I would like to see more people who are qualified, who know how to actively like help folks with this type of information.
Yeah, I
And
think.
as you come into the movement as well, like how awful.
Right.
I don't know what happened with you, but if you have a young person who's going to now be exposed to this information that will be with you for the rest of your life, turning over in your mind, you need to be equipped to know how to handle that. And I just don't think it's very fair. Then we ask people to come and be activists, and we don't have any framework to help people. Like, what do you do when you see these images that things? I mean, I'm like with the alligator thing that I recently saw, where do you, I don't even want to repeat to people how they kill these alligators and how they're kept in these conditions. Those images are there. And I just saw that by accident on Twitter the other day. So we need some kind of, we need some professional structural, and this is my
Yeah.
plea. So that the recent study I did on the graphic images and how people maintain it as long-term activists, at the end of that essay, at the end of that journal article, I said it's up to the nonprofits now. The grassroots, I would hope that could do it as well. They lack that those resources, but at least the major organizations with the funding to do it have somebody on staff that can help with recruitment when people enter into the movement or people become employees at that nonprofit. When we're doing campaigns, have that person there who's a trained expert in how to handle these things so that we're not just like mentally damaging people and hoping for the
Yeah.
best. It's not going to be a productive, healthy movement.
Do you follow the work of Claire Mann in Australia?
Don't think I've heard that before.
She wrote this book. I've had her on the podcast, and she wrote a book called, or she coined the term dystopia with a V, talking about the like vegans, the world they see being like instead of dystopia, vistopia. And like how to be vegan in a non-vegan world. Basically, the things we're talking about, she's started exploring. I would check her out.
As a vegan psychologist.
And some of her stuff definitely is very individual in terms of psychology versus sociology. But the conversation of how do you be vegan and be healthy in a world that is not set up to support that, those conversations she very much facilitates.
Great. Yeah, this is new to me. I'm just seeing a bunch of stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, she's got oodles of information. I found her. I actually, when I was more in my early vegan, I was having mental health issues for other things going on in my life as well. But I was still looking at a lot of the graphics and I was traumatized. I was just like, I can't handle this. My partner at the time wasn't vegan. There wasn't a lot of people immediately around me. No one got it in the same way. Not that people were being mean or anything, but no one got it.
Yeah.
And I think I booked a free call with her. This was before I had a podcast and was just like, I'm vegan and I'm not okay. And I don't know what to do. And talked to her, and she was so kind
Yeah.
and addressed that kind of, yeah, you're right. You're vegan and it's a non-vegan world. So what do
Yeah.
we do? And I think people are still figuring that out, but it's worth having that conversation because I don't like when vegans are like, it's easy and everything's fine. It's easy to go vegan, which in some ways it so is, without being like, yeah, but you're gonna learn some things that you're not gonna want to know, and that's
Yeah.
real too.
Yeah. And you're right with about the no support systems. I have a support system, but if they don't get it, they don't get it. So you feel like you're
Yeah.
also explaining why you're so upset so that they can, you feel justified for being so upset, and it just doesn't register.
Yes.
Yeah,
Yes.
this is wonderful that you've, yeah, I found that. Yeah, you found this for me. I'm going to check that out.
So glad. Did you have anything else to share that I haven't given you space to do?
No, I think we covered quite a lot, and we got a lot of sociology in there as well.
Yeah, I so appreciated this conversation and would love to continue to connect and whatever that looks like in the future. I love now following your work and really appreciate what you're doing for the movement.
Oh, same. Thank you very much. Oh,
Yeah,
it's a nice
thank you.
conversation. It's a different conversation. I like that.
If you're hearing this message, you've listened to the entire episode of Consciously Clueless, and for that, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this new episode, and if you did, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or tag me and share in social media. Share this episode with others who may be interested in this topic. To get more resources, influence on topics covered, and bonus content, join the Consciously Clueless community over on Patreon at patreon.com/consciouslycarly. And don't forget, if you need help living more consciously, let's work together. Email me today. See you next Wednesday for a new episode.